last powers and move onto the battlefield. Traveling in the All Souls world. By horse. From the point of view of most vampires, including the de Clermont family, the internal combustion engine is a relatively recent invention. For most of their lives, they have relied upon horses to travel distances, hunt, and go to war. And although Matthew, Marcus, and Baldwin are extremely fond of their helicopters, private airplanes, and luxury automobiles, they also keep a stable of magnificent horses at Septour. There are 7 animals in residence at the moment, including Matthew's jet-black draft horse stallion, Balthazar. He is very like the huge, sturdy war horses that Matthew and the other vampires rode into battle in full armor in the past. There are also 2 smaller Andalusian mares for the women of the household. Isabel prefers Fidat, Arabic for silver, as she is the more obedient of the two, and Diana rides Narakasa, Arabic for fire dancer, the more willful mare, with whom Diana has formed a bond, sealed with kind words and apples. As Andalusians, these mares are descendants of Iberian horses. Renowned in Spain and throughout Europe for centuries, they are famed for their speed and athleticism, as well as their strength and endurance. They exhibit many of the most notable qualities of their vampire owners. The de Clermonts are excellent riders, having spent centuries in the saddle. Fortunately, Diana Bishop is also a fine equestrian, having grown up in the country and ridden horses since she was a child. Those years of experience, coupled with her almost unconscious and certainly magical ability to ride with her eyes closed, speaking silently to Rakasa with her mind, means that she can hold her own with the de Clermonts. Matthew is unsettled by Diana's style, as it runs counter to his instinct to protect her. But Isabel takes Diana's horsemanship in stride. The first time Isabel went riding with Diana, Isabel instructed the groom to use side saddles for both horses, though Diana had always ridden astride. For Isabel, the invention of the modern side saddle was a marvelous step forward. Prior to its introduction, genteel women could not ride out by themselves. They either rode on a pillion behind a man, or sat sidewise in an armchair saddle while their horses were led by men, because a woman could not control her horse while seated this way. Fortunately for Isabel and many other women, Catherine de Medici invented the side saddle in the mid-1500s, so that she could ride out with her husband, Francis King Henry II. He had been accustomed to riding with his mistress, Diane de Poitiers, who rode astride. Catherine's style of side saddle, which Isabeau and Diana also used, allowed women to control their own horse by facing forward and sliding their right leg over the front pommel of the saddle, with a horn to support the right knee. The left leg rested in a slipper stirrup, and the rider's skirted leg stayed modestly together on the same side of the horse. This allowed women to ride securely at moderate speeds. But Matthew was right to forbid Isabel from taking Diana jumping in the 16th century side saddle. It wasn't until the 1830s that Jules Pellier invented the modern side saddle, with the addition of a second pommel called a running or leaping horn, that finally allowed horses and their side saddle riders to run and jump securely. Even today, some women ride and compete side saddle, though more because of the challenge and style of it, rather than out of any concerns for modesty or gentility. Like King Henry II and his mistress, Diane de Poitiers, Matthew and Diana rode astride on their days-long journey to Septour in the 16th century, and even then the trip was physically exhausting. Diana's many years of experience had still not prepared her for the physical toll of spending day after day in the saddle. By car. Over their long lives, vampires have developed an appreciation for items of lasting quality. Likewise, most have sizable bank accounts. This means that today many vampires, and the de Clermonts in particular, drive extraordinarily fine automobiles. Matthew is partial to Jaguars and Land Rovers. The first time he drove Diana, it was in an impeccably kept older model Jaguar. When traveling in more rural locales, including around Septour or the Bishop House in upstate New York, Matthew prefers his Range Rovers, which are less refined than his Jags, but much sturdier. Diana compared his Land Rover to an armored personnel carrier. On the other hand, Marcus Whitmore, Matthew's son, enjoys flashier wheels. He finds sport cars irresistible. This includes his hand-built Spiker Spider, with doors that open by scissoring upward, and an aviation-style chrome dashboard. Marcus has other soft-top two-seaters, including an Alfa Romeo Spider, as well as any number of Spider cars produced by European and American carmakers, like the Porsche 550 Spider and the Lamborghini Gallardo Spider. The Spider in question refers not to a car's fondness for stalking its victims, though that does seem awfully appropriate for vampires. Instead, these Spider cars are modern versions of a 19th-century horse-drawn carriage, known as the Spider Phaeton. These were lightweight, very fast, four-wheeled carriages, designed to carry a gentleman driver and perhaps one other passenger, possibly with a footman clinging to the back. The Spider Phaeton was elegant and stylish, and above all, it was designed for speed. One assumes that Marcus was an early adopter of the Spider Phaeton when it was introduced in 19th century America. Certainly, he appreciates the mechanical, gas-powered versions of the modern era. The Bishop women, by contrast, drive more sensible vehicles. For years, Sarah drove a beat-up Honda Civic with faded purple paint and plastered with bumper stickers. Exercise in the All Souls world. Rowing. Rowing was a vital part of Diana's regime at Oxford for calming the surges of anxiety that have plagued her since childhood. The ritual of getting the boat ready, the meditative quality of rowing's repetitive movements, and the serenity of being on the river early in the morning, at dusk, or on a foggy day, all made it one of the perfect ways for Diana to get the exercise she needed and to clear her mind. Diana rowed in a single scull, which gave her the freedom to train when it suited her, and to avoid the many Oxford College crews crowding the Isis. It's not surprising Diana was drawn into this sport at Oxford, a university famous for its culture of rowing. On top of the famous Oxford and Cambridge boat race, the tradition of intercollege rivalry within Oxford is fierce. While Diana was on the river, she overheard other rowers discussing their tactics for the bumps. These are two series of races officially called Torpids in early March, and 8 weeks, or summer eights, in May, involving all the Oxford colleges, including Diana's new college. Taking place on the Isis, a narrow stretch of the River Thames through Oxford, the competition entails crews lined up in their divisions, one after the other, with about a boat and a half's width between them. Racing is started by the firing of a gun. The aim is for each crew to catch up and bump the boat in front, as well as avoid being caught by those chasing them. Once a bump has occurred, the crews involved must stop and let the other racers pass. Their positions are then swapped for the next competition, be that the next day or the following year's regatta. The ultimate aim is for a crew to bump its way up to become head of the river. The triumphant crew is awarded blades, trophy oars painted in its college colors. The roots of this idiosyncratic regatta can be traced back to the first formally recorded race in 1815. Brazenose and Jesus College crews came head-to-head in eights, racing from Iffley Lock to Mr. King's Barge, which was moored near where the finishing line is today, and the head of the river pub. Brazenose was the winner.
For those of you wondering, yes, I did row. At Oxford, as a matter of fact, where I was, for a few brief, wonderful terms, a member of the Keble College Women's First Eight. I was a member of the Second Eight for a full year, too. Rowing was, for me, exactly as described here, part meditation, part discipline, partly a reminder that I was not just mind, but body, too. That may sound obvious, but for a PhD candidate working on her dissertation in the Bodleian, it was all too easy to forget that I needed to eat and sleep occasionally. As someone who was always terrible at sports that demanded hand-eye coordination, I have virtually none, discovering horseback riding, rowing, and yoga saved me from a totally sedentary life. I still ride and row on a rowing machine in the backyard, not a river, and do yoga, and they save my life each and every day by instilling a quiet place in my mind where stories, like a discovery of witches, are born.
Yoga. Diana Bishop practices yoga, along with running and rowing, to help manage her anxiety, which arose from being spellbound, but for many years Diana had no idea of this. Yoga is an ancient spiritual, mental, and physical practice that originated in northern India more than 5,000 years ago. There is a wide variety of yoga schools and practices. Most teach students to use breath control, along with simple meditation and a series of physical poses called asanas, such as the standing pose known as tree, or the inverted V of downward dog pose. The breathing, meditation, and physical poses all work together to induce tranquility and inner peace, which is particularly useful to creatures compelled to exist uncomfortably alongside humans. When Diana met Matthew Claremont in Oxford, she learned that he'd been practicing yoga for centuries. He introduced her to his favorite yoga class, led by the insightful witch and yogini, Amara Chavan. Held in the Great Hall of the Old Lodge in Woodstock, this class contained an extraordinary mix of witches, vampires, and demons, who gathered harmoniously, with none of the usual discomfort and uneasiness that can arise among creatures mingling together. In this class, creatures learn to manage their energy and, for a short time at least, be wholly themselves. Amira acknowledges that they all live in a world where humans ignore or fear them, so we spend our time striving and straining to be something that we're not. Let those desires go. Honor who you are. Despite the distractions of vampires who scarcely seemed to draw breath and witches who floated above the ground, Diana found immense comfort and relief from her own roiling thoughts and worries through yoga's movement and concentration. Amira's admonition to honor who you are served as an important reminder to Diana as she began her journey to embrace her identity and powers as a witch. Even her Aunt Em believes that magic and yoga share common ground, because both require stillness and a present mind, emptied of whirling, distracting thoughts.
I've practiced Iyengar, Anusara, and Vinyasa Flow Yoga. My inspiration for a creatures class at the Old Lodge came from a time when I was in a yoga class trying to do downward dog, and while upside down, I spotted someone who seemed to be balancing on a bit of her forearm and her ear. Obviously, that person was not human.
Literature. The Literature of All Souls. Books lie at the center of All Souls, beginning with the mysterious Ashmole 782. They are what drive the story and are woven into every aspect of Diana and Matthew's life. Collected here are some of the alchemical works, mythology, history, stories, and poetry that have shaped their experiences and the way in which they see the world. Alchemy.
Who will carry the blood of the lion and the wolf? See the bearer of the tenth knot, for the last shall once more be the first.
Title: Anthropologia, or a treatise containing a short description of man in two parts, the first anatomical, the second psychological, aka Ashmole 782. Author: unknown. Background: one of the Bodleian Library's early donors was Elias Ashmole, 1617 to 92, a great bibliophile and collector, and a serious student of alchemy, astrology, and other scientific pursuits. When he died, he left funds to the university to set up a museum and library, open today as the Ashmolean Museum. Into this museum went his collections of natural objects, ancient coins, and poetry, as well as hundreds of books and manuscripts. In 1858, the contents of Ashmole's library were offered to the Bodleian. The books were catalogued, and the manuscripts were numbered and given the designation Ashmole Manuscripts. A manuscript with the description Anthropologia, or a treatise containing a short description of man in two parts, the first anatomical, the second psychological, was tagged as Ashmole Manuscript 782. Its contents and its current whereabouts are unknown. Perhaps it was entered into the catalog by mistake. Perhaps a librarian's closer inspection revealed that it was a printed book, and it was sent to another part of the library for cataloging. It might simply be misshelved, or it might have been absorbed into the body of a certain weaver from Madison, New York. Ashmole 782, known also as the Book of Life, is the mystery at the heart of the All Souls trilogy. Depending on whom you ask, it is a precious book containing the secret of immortality that the witches stole from the vampires, an ancient spellbook stolen by vampires from witches, or the solution to the demons' question as to why they exist. For every creature, demon, human, vampire, or witch, it provides answers to the question of who we are and what makes us human, or not.
As a scholar, I've done a lot of research among the Ashmole alchemical manuscripts and always wondered what Ashmole 782 might contain. Incidentally, I did once find a lost book at the Bodleian, the Book of Soiga or Alderaya, a copy of which was owned by John Dee, is a 16th century treatise on magic. It was thought to be lost until I helped to uncover two copies in the British Library and the Bodleian.
As I am the end, so my lover is the beginning. I encompass the whole work of creation, and all knowledge is hidden in me. Who will dare to separate me from my love? No one, for our love is as strong as death.
Title: Aurora Consurgens, Rising Dawn. Author: Attributed to Thomas Aquinas, 1225-74. Background: Aurora Consurgens is a 15th century manuscript about the opposing forces of alchemical transformation, silver and gold, female and male, dark and light. It is a commentary on a manuscript called Silvery Waters, written by the alchemist Muhammad ibn Umayl at-Tamimi, also known as Ibn Umayl, in the 10th century. Seven copies are known to exist, not counting Matthew de Clermont's copy, of course. The earliest known copy of the Aurora is from the 1420s. It contains 38 images showing allegorical representations of alchemical elements depicted in human or animal form, alchemical metaphors relating to human and animal procreation, and stages of the alchemical art of transformation. Matthew has a copy of the Aurora dated 1356, containing 40 images. Because the Aurora is one of the most important alchemical treatises ever written, Matthew was able to convince Diana to come to his house in France by offering to let her see his hitherto unknown copy. Bourgeot Lenoir, whom Matthew revealed did the illustrations for his copy, was the daughter of the famous 14th century illuminator Jean Lenoir. She lived and worked with her father in Paris, and their work was widely praised and patronized by French nobles of the time. Matthew's copy includes an illustration of the chemical wedding of gold, representing the male principle in alchemical change, and silver, representing the female principle. Diana came to realize that these illustrations echo the second page of Ashmole 782, which shows the alchemical wedding of mercury and sulfur, a crucial step in making the philosopher's stone, in which a golden-haired woman in white offers a white rose to a pale, dark-haired husband. It also represents her own wedding with Matthew, which results in the creation of a new element, their bright-born children.
It is with the philosopher's stone as with the sea serpent. Some say they have seen it, while the whole mass of mankind has not. But the evidence of the few who have seen outweighs the opinion of the many who have not. A thing still is, though people know nothing about it.
Title: Splendor Solis, The Splendor of the Sun. Author: Attributed to Salomon Trismosen. Background: Splendor Solis is a famous illustrated alchemical manuscript whose author was supposed to be the legendary Salomon Trismosen, allegedly the teacher of Paracelsus. The earliest version was written in central German around 1532-35, and 20 copies are known to exist currently. Splendor Solis is composed of 22 images that symbolize the process of the alchemical death and rebirth of the king, as well as a series of 7 flasks, each of which is associated with one of the planets. Splendor Solis is different from other alchemical manuscripts in that it is not a lab manual, but rather the expression of the philosophy of alchemy, in which the alchemist acts in harmony with nature, respecting divine creation, while intervening in the process underlying that creation. One of the most beautiful of the Splendor Solis manuscripts is the copy known as Harley 3469, housed at the British Library.
This magnificent illuminated manuscript is the one I consulted and used as a starting point for imagining the chemical wedding page of Ashmole 782.
Take your pot of mercury and seethe it over a flame for 3 hours. And when it has joined with the philosophical child, take it and let it putrefy until the black crow carries it away to its death.
Title: Book of Alchemical Formulas. Author: Claudio de Domenico Celentano di Valnove. Background: The manuscript inside the next box was smaller than the last, but it contained interesting sketches of alchemical apparatus and snippets of chemical procedures that read like some unholy combination of Joy of Cooking and a poisoner's notebook. The Book of Alchemical Formulas is one of the manuscripts Diana needed to consult at the Bodleian Library in preparation for her upcoming keynote address. While she studied it, Matthew ensured her privacy by warding off all the curious creatures who had come to stare at her. The Book of Alchemical Formulas is an obscure alchemical manuscript produced in Naples in 1606. Its illustrations range from exotic allegorical images to practical representations of the laboratory process required in alchemy. Celentano states that the Philosopher's Stone is red mercury, that is, mercury sulfide, which occurs naturally in cinnabar and was used for vermilion paint. Stages of the alchemical process were often tied to colors to represent the cycles of nature's creations. Nigredo, blackening, albedo, whitening, and rubedo, reddening, to represent putrefaction, purification, and perfection. A successful experiment is marked by a red rose.
Nevertheless, I stoutly maintain that the art of alchemy is clear and true, and founded upon nature, that its products are as truly silver and gold as the precious metals which are produced in the bowels of the earth, and that I am fully prepared to substantiate all these assertions in the following chapters, and to place them beyond the reach of reasonable doubt. We will triumphantly rebut the attacks of Aristotle, and refute all other objections, putting them to flight with the all-prevailing weapons of truth and reason.
Title: Pretiosa Margarita Novella, New Pearl of Great Price. Author: A Compendium of Alchemical Texts Made by Petrus Bonus, of Works by Arnold Villanova, Lull, Rassus, Albertus Magnus, and Michael Scott. Background: Diana Bishop read this collection with Mary Sidney while the two of them worked together in the laboratory at Baynard's Castle. It is a compendium of alchemical texts assembled by Petrus Bonus in 1330, although no manuscripts exist from that period. The manuscript was printed in 1546 by the famous Renaissance printer Aldus, who is credited with introducing a badly needed standardized system of punctuation. Its initial illustrations show the death and subsequent resurrection of a king, a common theme used by alchemists. It is not known whether the illustrations date from the 14th century or were created for the Aldus version. In the book, a king is killed by his son, from whom he has been withholding his power. After the king is interred, the son is forced to join him in his tomb. Alchemically speaking, the king is buried with the agent that killed him. The tomb is closed, and later some of the bones are removed. Then the courtiers pray to God, and a series of angels place the bones on the earth. In alchemical terms, the bones represent the decomposed substance in the alchemist's flask, and the angels are the series of actions that transform this substance from putrefaction, death, to reddening, life. At the reddening stage, the king is resurrected and transformed by having absorbed the agent, his son, that led to his death. The king completes the transformation process by sharing his power with his son. The remainder of the book is a treatise on the virtues associated with alchemical practice.
The which causeth our generation betwixt the man and the woman, so look that there be no division. Be there in the conjunction of the moon and of the sun. After the marriage is begun, and all the while they be a wedding, Give him to her drinking acetum that is good and fine, better to him than any wine. Now, when this marriage is done, philosophers call this a stone, the which hath great nature, to bring a stone yet is so pure.
Title: The Ripley Scroll. Author: Unknown. Background: The dragon was not a dragon, for it had only two legs. It was a fire drake and carried its barbed tail in its mouth, like the Ouroboros on the de Clermont banner. The fire drake's head was tilted to the sky, and it held a crescent moon in its jaws. A multi-pointed star rose above it. Matthew's emblem. George Ripley was one of England's most famous alchemists, most widely known for his work The Compound of Alchemy, which was dedicated to King Edward IV in 1471. This poem best describes the way to make the Philosopher's Stone, the substance that was supposed to transmute base metal into gold and confer long life on its possessor. Ripley's works were studied both during his lifetime and after his death by natural philosophers and scientists such as John Dee, Robert Boyle, and Isaac Newton. The manuscripts now known as the Ripley Scrolls provide allegorical images of the processes involved in making the Philosopher's Stone. They were actually created in the 16th and early 17th centuries, after Ripley's death, and are copies of some long-lost originals. Though there is no evidence that Ripley in fact designed the original on which the scrolls are based, they were named after him because some of them include lines of his poetry, and their imagery derives from his poem. Ripley's scrolls are very rare. Only around 24 survive, and they are seldom displayed because of their fragility. Sometimes, as with the Yale copy, the scrolls were cut into sections to prevent damage by being unrolled and re-rolled. In this fragmented form, it's hard to picture them as a 40-foot mural, but that's the great thing about fiction. Mythology.
I sing of Artemis, whose shafts are of gold, who cheers on the hounds, the pure maiden, shooter of stags, who delights in archery, own sister to Apollo with the golden sword. Over the shadowy hills and windy peaks she draws her golden bow, rejoicing in the chase, and sends out grievous shafts. And when she is satisfied and has cheered her heart, this huntress who delights in arrows slackens her supple bow and goes to the great house of her dear brother Phoebus Apollo, to the rich land of Delphi, there to order the lovely dance of the Muses and Graces.
Myth: Artemis / Diana. Origin: Greek, possibly pre-Greek, and Roman mythology. Background: Diana is a Roman goddess whose origins go back at least as far as the 6th century, when Severus Tullius, the 6th king of Rome, according to legend, dedicated a temple to her on Rome's Aventine Hill. Diana was goddess of both wild and domestic animals, of the hunt, and of childbirth. She is usually portrayed as a beautiful young woman wearing a short tunic and holding a bow, with a quiver of arrows slung over her shoulder, often accompanied by a deer. She lives on in the goddess that Diana Bishop and her family venerate. Diana may originally have been an indigenous woodland goddess, but over time she became identified with the Greek goddess Artemis as well. Throughout the trilogy, Diana Bishop is closely associated with both. The Dianic Temple on Aventine Hill was dedicated on August 13th, Diana Bishop's birthday. Artemis had a twin brother named Apollo. Diana Bishop had a twin brother who died in the womb. The goddess Diana appears to Diana Bishop several times as a white deer. Most of all, Diana Bishop is linked to the goddess through her role as dispenser of justice. The goddess is linked not only to Diana Bishop, but also to Matthew de Clermont. One of the names Philippe uses for the goddess is Artemis Lyce, Lady of the Wolves. Because of her association with Artemis, the goddess Diana also absorbed Artemis's connection with the moon goddess, Selene in Greek, Luna in Latin. Selene was associated with the crescent moon, which appears on the seal of the Knights of Lazarus.
And lo, from opening clouds I saw emerge the loveliest moon that ever silvered o'er. A shell for Neptune's goblet, she did soar so passionately bright, my dazzled soul, commingling with her argent spheres, did roll through clear and cloudy. Even when she went, at last, into a dark and vapory tent.
Myth. Endymion. Origin. Greek mythology. Background. According to Greek myth, the moon goddess Selene was in love with a handsome Greek named Endymion. The myth has several variations, in which Endymion appears variously as a shepherd, a hunter, or a king. Pliny the Elder claimed that Endymion was the first human to observe the movements of the moon, so he might also have been an early astronomer. In any case, Selene is grieved that Endymion will eventually die, so she beseeches Zeus to make him immortal. Zeus grants her wish by casting Endymion into perpetual sleep. Evidently, Endymion was not a deep sleeper, because he and Selene were supposed to have had 50 daughters, whom scholars believe represented the 50 lunar months. The ancient Greeks devised a calendar called the Octarius, which was 8 solar years, or 99 lunar months. According to legend and Greek historians, the Greeks started keeping this 8-year calendar when they began the Olympic Games in 776 BC. In time, the Octarius came to be measured in 2 4-year periods, which the Greeks called Olympiads. The myth of Endymion appeared in Shadow of Night because of the Emperor Rudolf II's attraction to Diana Bishop, whom he dubbed La Diosa. He hoped to convince her to participate with him in a risque play, specifically as enactment of the myth in which the young hunter Actaeon surprises the goddess Diana naked in her bath. La Diosa quickly suggested the myth of Diana and Endymion instead, with Matthew as Endymion and Rudolf as Zeus. The resulting production bore more resemblance to a Monty Python skit than to a classical play. But at least it stayed within the bounds of propriety.
To appoint me penalties and tasks, Earth is not broad enough for Juno's hate. I have seen places unapproached by any, unknown to Phoebus. Those gloomy spaces which the baser pole hath yielded to infernal Jove. And if the regions of the third estate pleased me, I might have reigned. The chaos of everlasting night, and something worse than night, and the grim gods and the fates, all these I saw, and, having flouted death, I have come back.
Myth. Heracles / Hercules. Origin. Greek and Roman mythology, from at least as early as the 1st century BC. Background. Heracles, known to the Romans as Hercules, was one of the greatest Greek heroes. In addition to being semi-divine, he was the epitome of strength, masculinity, and courage. He was the son of Zeus, through a liaison with the mortal woman Alcmene. Zeus tricked Alcmene into sleeping with him one night by disguising himself as her husband Amphitryon. Later that night, Amphitryon returned from war and slept with his wife as well. 2 sons were conceived, Heracles, the son of Zeus, and Iphicles, the son of Amphitryon. It is actually possible, though rare, for a woman to become pregnant with twins from 2 different fathers. Zeus's wife, Hera, was notoriously jealous and hated Heracles for providing constant evidence of Zeus's infidelity. So she persecuted Heracles throughout his life. Heracles was originally named Eclides by his parents, but they later changed his name as an homage to Hera to try to mitigate her hatred. This was unsuccessful. Hera afflicted Heracles with madness, causing him to slaughter his wife and children. His punishment was to carry out 10, later 12, almost impossible tasks, the famous labors of Hercules. Among these were slaying the Nemean lion, cleaning the Augean stables, home to over 3,000 head of cattle, in a single day, and capturing Cerberus, the hound that guards the gates of the underworld. For his role in the slaying of monsters, Heracles came to be associated with the protection of mankind. As readers of the trilogy know, the vampire Philippe de Clermont has many traits in common with Heracles. Heracles is often portrayed wearing a lion skin. As Diana noted, Philippe strongly resembled a lion. Heracles' 11th labor was to best the giant Antaeus in a wrestling match. Galloglass reported that Philippe wrestled a giant once. In the sacred grove of the goddess Diana near Septuor, Philippe referred to himself by Heracles' original given name, Eclides, followed by Leonthothymus, the lion-hearted. In his Varia Historia, Various Histories, the Roman author Aelian recounted how Heracles was fond of games and often played with children. Like Philippe, who appointed a child lord of misrule on Saturnalia and obeyed his command to dance with the servant Alain. And tragically, in a parallel to Heracles, Philippe was driven mad by his sufferings in a Nazi concentration camp, although nothing could induce him to hurt his beloved Isabeau.
To Nereus and rich-haired Doris, daughter of Okeanos, Oceanus, they were born in the barren sea, daughters greatly beautiful, even among goddesses. 50 Nereids are named, ending with Nemertes, whose mind is like that of her immortal father. These were the daughters born to irreproachable Nereus, 50 in all, and the actions they know are beyond reproach also.
Myth. Nereus. Origin. Greek or pre-Greek mythology. Background. Nereus was the oldest son of Pontus, the sea, and Gaius, the earth. Homer's Iliad described the old man of the sea, who fathered the sea nymphs called the Nereids, though the Iliad didn't mention Nereus by name. Though he was a shapeshifter, Nereus was known for telling no lies, and for being the most trustworthy and gentle of creatures. He could also prophesy the future. He was eventually supplanted by another sea god, Triton. Nereus was instrumental in enabling Heracles to fulfill his 11th labor, stealing golden apples from the Garden of Hesperides. Before Hercules could set out on his journey, he had to wrestle the shape-shifting god to force him to provide directions. One of Nereus's daughters, Thetis, married Peleus and became the mother of the Greek hero, Achilles.
Far happier then were the times for men, fondly yearned for now. You heroes, so bred of gods in those silver days, favor me as I call you now with my magic song.
Myth. Peleus and Thetis. Origin. Greek mythology. Pre-8th century BC. Background. The myth of Peleus is mentioned in Homer's Odyssey. Peleus was not a god, but a hero who was a friend of Hercules and served in the quest for the Golden Fleece. He was originally married to Antigone, who hanged herself after Peleus was falsely accused of infidelity. He then married Thetis, who was a Nereid, one of 50 daughters of the sea god Nereus. It had been prophesied that the son born to Thetis would be greater than his father, a daunting prospect for a prospective husband. Also, like her father, Thetis was a shapeshifter who could transform herself into water and fire and air, and most men were afraid to take her for a wife. On advice from the centaur Chiron, however, Peleus clasped Thetis to his heart while she changed from water to fire to serpent to lioness. Once she became a woman again, he took her to his home, and the two were wed. Incidentally, it is at their wedding that Eris, the Greek goddess of discord, who had not been invited, produced the golden apple of discord that eventually led to the Trojan War. We've all known people like this. It's fitting that Philippe told the story of Peleus and Thetis at Matthew and Diana's wedding. They too must hold on to each other through a series of changes and revelations that would have deterred lesser creatures.
Those words stirred within Achilles a deep desire to grieve for his own father. And, overpowered by memory, both men gave way to grief. Priam wept freely for man-killing Hector, throbbing, crouching, before Achilles' feet as Achilles wept himself, now for his father, now for Patroclus once again, and their sobbing rose and fell throughout the house.
Myth. Achilles. Origin. Greek or pre-Greek mythology. Background. Achilles was the only surviving son of Peleus and Thetis's 7 sons. Understandably, Thetis wanted to make Achilles invulnerable. In some versions of the myth, she did this by holding him by the heel and dipping him into the river Styx, leaving his heel, his Achilles heel, unprotected. In other versions, she anointed him with ambrosia during the day and burned away the mortal parts of his body by night. When Peleus interrupted her efforts, however, she furiously leaped into the sea and never returned. Peleus then gave Achilles to his former teacher, the centaur Chiron, to raise. Achilles became a hero of the Trojan War and a central character in Homer's Iliad, where he is portrayed as proud, stubborn, and often driven by rage. After Hector, the son of Sparta's King Priam, killed Achilles' dear friend Patroclus, Achilles killed Hector and desecrated his body so viciously that even the gods were upset and intervened. It's no wonder that when Philippe recounted the tale of Peleus and Thetis, Diana thought, I was glad that his father didn't give a full account of the wedding and how the Trojan War got started there. And I was even happier that he didn't go on to tell the tale of Achilles' youth, the horrible spells his mother used to try to make him immortal as she was, and the young man's uncontrollable rage, which caused him far more trouble than did his famously unprotected heel. Diana probably recognized that Achilles' worst traits parallel those of Matthew de Clermont.
But I can tell you what to do, to come unchanged from Circe's power, and disenthrall your fighting crew. Take with you to her bower, as amulet, this plant I know. It will defeat her horrid show. When she turns cruel, coming near with her long stick to whip you out of doors, then let your cutting blade appear. Let instant death upon it shine, and she will cower and yield her bed. A pleasure you must not decline. So may her lust and fear bestead you and your friends, and break her spell. But make her swear by heaven and hell, no witch's tricks, or else, your harness shed, you'll be unmanned by her as well.
Myth. Odysseus and Circe. Origin. Greek mythology / legend. Background. Odysseus was a legendary Greek hero whose adventures are recounted both in Homer's Iliad, which takes place during the Trojan War, and in its sequel, the Odyssey, which tells the story of Odysseus's 10-year journey home afterward. Odysseus was Achilles' opposite, wily, restrained, and cerebral, as well as strong. Odysseus was responsible for the ruse of the Trojan horse, which enabled the Greeks to win the war. The Greeks admired such traits, but the Romans, who called him Ulysses, were not impressed. Odysseus's tricks offended the Roman sense of honor, and in any case, they preferred the Trojan side of the story, because they held themselves to be descendants of the Trojan hero Aeneas. Circe was known sometimes as a goddess of magic, sometimes as a witch or a sorceress. According to some sources, her mother was Hecate, the goddess of witchcraft. Circe was known for her knowledge of herbs and potions, and she had the ability to turn her enemies into animals. Odysseus and his men visited her island of Aenea during their voyage to Odysseus's home, where she transformed some of the men into swine after a feast of wine and cheese. This still happens occasionally. Odysseus did not attend the feast, and so did not fall prey to this trick. Before Odysseus confronted Circe, the god Hermes provided him with an antidote to her witchcraft. Hermes also warned that when Circe invited Odysseus to bed, he must make her swear on the names of all the gods not to take his manhood. With this assurance, Odysseus remained with Circe for a full year before his men could convince him to move on, while his wife, Penelope, sat at home and weaved. The story of Odysseus and Circe was another one of the Emperor Rudolph's suggestions for a spring mask, starring himself and Diana Bishop. The idea of begging Diana not to take his manhood held a perverse appeal. She quickly suggested the story of Diana and Endymion, with Rudolph playing the role of Zeus.
She saw Valkyries come from far and wide, ready to ride to Godpiad. Skald held a shield, and Skogul was another. Gunnar, Hilda, Gondel, and Gyrskogul.
Myth. Gundel, Odin's daughter. Origin, Norse mythology. Background. In Norse mythology, Gundel is a Valkyrie, sometimes also referred to as a daughter of the great god Odin. She is mentioned in the Heimskringla, a collection of sagas about the Norse kings, written by Snorri Sturluson around the year AD 1230, and in a poem in the 13th century, Poetic Edda. The word Valkyrie comes from the Old Norse Valkyra, literally, chooser of the slain. The Valkyries were female warrior goddesses who influenced the course of battle and served Odin's wishes as to which warrior should live and which would die. The best warriors who died in battle went to Valhalla, Odin's Hall of the Slain, so that they could later serve on his side in the eschatological battle that was to end the current cosmic order. Warriors who wanted to be taken by the Valkyries fought in a terrible trance-like fury, abandoning all humanity. Some, called berserkers, from the Old Norse berserkr, or bear shirts, wore during battle a shirt or coat made from the pelt of a bear. Odin was sometimes represented by a bear, and the berserkers hoped to gain favor with him by wearing its pelt. The Ylfjörnar, from the Old Norse for wolf hides, on the other hand, dressed in the pelts of wolves. Basically, both groups fought like animals. When Diana Bishop first met Galloglass, she asked Matthew, "This berserker is your nephew?" Galloglass mildly replied, "For your information, my people were Ylfjörnar, not berserkers. And I'm only part Norse, the gentle part, if you must know. The rest is Scots, by way of Ireland." Galloglass once compared Diana with Gundul. Fittingly, since the name is said to come from the Old Norse Gundr, meaning magic or magic wand.
Hugin and Munin fly each day over the spacious earth. I fear for Hugin that he come not back, yet more anxious am I for Munin.
Myth. Hugin and Munin. Origin, Norse mythology. Background. Munin derives from the Old Norse for memory or mind, and Hugin derives from the word for thought. In Norse mythology, these are the names of the two ravens who fly all over the world to provide intelligence to the god Odin. The ravens are mentioned in a collection of anonymous Old Norse minstrel poems, now referred to as the Poetic Edda. The poems were compiled in the 13th century from sources whose exact date is not known. While Diana and Matthew were in Prague, staying at a house called the Three Ravens, Galloglass compared himself and Matthew with Odin's ravens. Fittingly, Galloglass is Munin, memory, and the intellectual Matthew is Hugin, thought.
All they could do was make sure their children knew Dagwenoyant's legend, carefully instructing them how to kill such a creature by burning him, grinding his bones into powder, and dispersing it to the four winds, so that he could not be reborn.
Myth. Dagwenoyant. Origin. Iroquois mythology. Background. Dagwenoyant is a mythic figure of the Iroquois people. According to a legend of the Seneca tribe, she was the daughter of the wind, a vicious witch who could travel in a whirlwind and could not be killed. One story is that an uncle and a nephew lived near Dagwenoyant and her child, and the nephew was forbidden any contact with them. The nephew disobeyed, however, and often sneaked off to visit them. When the child turned 15, he revealed to the nephew that they were both cousins and that the uncle was Dagwenoyant's husband. The boy was upset and pierced a bag of oil that hung over Dagwenoyant's head. Later he confessed this to his uncle, who told him they were now in great danger. Soon Dagwenoyant came to the uncle's house as a whirlwind and destroyed it, carrying him away. The nephew and his guardian, Mole, searched for the uncle and rescued him from under an elm tree. They went to Dagwenoyant's house and killed her by burning her body in a fire of bear oil. She revived, however, and once again the uncle and the nephew killed her with fire. Afterward, they pounded her bones into a fine powder and divided the powder into three separate bags, one each for uncle, nephew, and Mole. Whenever there is a storm, they must keep the bags apart so that the powder can't unite and revive Dagwenoyant. During the Revolutionary War, it is understandable that the Oneida, who were closely allied with the Seneca, referred to Matthew as Dagwenoyant. Like her, he is difficult to kill, except perhaps by fire. History, magic, science, and religion.
Query 14. All that the witchfinder doth is to fleece the country of their money, and therefore rides and goes to towns to have employment, and promiseth them fair promises. And it may be doth nothing for it, and possesseth many men, that they have so many wizards and so many witches in their town, and so heartens them on to entertain him. Answer. You do him a great deal of wrong in every of these particulars.
Title. The Discovery of Witches. Author. Matthew Hopkins, circa 1620 to 47. Background. This historical volume, whose title is echoed by the All Souls trilogy's A Discovery of Witches, was written by the notorious 17th century English witchfinder, Matthew Hopkins. It first appeared in print in 1647 and lays out his revelations and methods for discovering and prosecuting witches. Matthew Hopkins turned to witch hunting in 1644, and along with his associate John Stern, focused his work on the towns and villages of England's eastern counties, particularly East Anglia. The huge increase of trials and executions for witchcraft at this time was a direct result of these two men's investigations. More people were hanged during the short period of their activity than from any of the witch hunts in the preceding 100 years. But as their reign of terror escalated, voices spoke out against them, and the expenses they demanded from each community they passed through. The discovery of witches, laid out as a set of queries and answers, reads like a vindication of Matthew Hopkins's methods and experience, as well as a denial of the accusation that he must needs be the greatest witch, sorcerer, and wizard himself, else he could not do it. To the relief of many, Hopkins retired soon after its publication and died in obscurity in 1647. Sadly, with the publication of this book, his legacy crossed borders. The witch trials that soon followed in the new colonies of America, particularly New England, adopted his methods, including the Salem witch trials, to which Diana's ancestor, Bridget Bishop, fell victim later in the century.
God suffers in the multitude of souls whom his word cannot reach. Religious truth is imprisoned in a small number of manuscript books, which confine, instead of spread, the public treasure. Let us break the seal which seals up holy things, and give wings to truth, in order that she may win every soul that comes into the world by her word, no longer written at great expense by hands easily palsied, but multiplied like the wind by an untiring machine. Johannes Gutenberg.
Title: Biblia Sacra, 1450, or Gutenberg Bible. Printer: Johannes Gutenberg, circa 1398 to 1468. Background: Matthew de Clermont's library in Septuor is full of astonishing treasures, his Gutenberg Bible being chief among them. One of the most famous books in the world, and probably one of the most expensive, the Biblia Sacra is the first Bible printed using movable type. It marked the birth of mass-produced literature, accelerating the spread of the written word in the West. Systems of movable type had been invented previously in Asia, but the far fewer characters in European languages made it a more viable method that, once perfected, took off in the Western world. Johannes Gutenberg's complex calculations ensure that the mechanics of the press worked in unison. He based the design on the wine presses of his area, producing metal type that could be applied with the correct and even pressure required not to tear the paper, and using oil-based ink that stuck to the type but would transfer easily to the paper without blotting the text. Copies of the Biblia Sacra, or 42-line Bible, as it is known due to the number of lines per page, were produced in Mainz in the 1450s by Gutenberg and his colleagues Johann Faust and Peter Schoeffer. Printing on vellum and the majority on paper, they combined the old and new, with the text printed on the presses and beautiful illuminations added later by hand in the traditional way. Before Gutenberg's revolutionary invention, the slow and painstaking process of handwriting works that still prevailed in Europe had made books expensive and exclusive. The printing press changed all that, allowing Renaissance advancements in thought and the ideas of the scientific revolution and the Reformation to be disseminated quickly to a much wider spectrum of people.
Nothing is miserable unless you think it so. And on the other hand, nothing brings happiness unless you are content with it.
Title: Consolation of Philosophy. Author: Anicius Manlius Severinius Boethius, commonly known as Boethius, circa 480 to 524. Background: when Matthew abruptly left Septuor after his encounter with the vampire Domenico, a grief-stricken Diana perused the contents of his study in an effort to know him better. On a shelf holding a wooden toy that had belonged to Lucas, Matthew's long-dead human son, Diana found a copy of Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. She instantly realized the significance of the work. I imagined Matthew, bereft of Blanca and Lucas, and bewildered by his new identity as a vampire, reading words written by a condemned man. Boethius was an imperial official under Theodoric the Great, Ostrogoth ruler of Rome, in the early 6th century. He became a senator at the age of 25 and held a number of important offices. But in a spectacular fall from favor, he was imprisoned for alleged treason in the year 523. A year later, Boethius was executed without a trial. It was during that time that he wrote the Consolation. Boethius was fluent in Greek and had studied the Platonic dialogues in which characters discuss moral and philosophical problems. Consolation was written in the form of a dialogue between Boethius and Lady Philosophy, and it described the peace that can be found through a contemplative state of mind. Boethius's ethical discussions resonate to this day. Are human beings essentially good? Does man possess free will? God is not mentioned, nor religion, but the work was a major influence on the Christianity of the Middle Ages. It also influenced the poetry of Geoffrey Chaucer, was cited in Dante's Divine Comedy, and is reflected in Boethian remarks by characters in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Clearly it influenced the young vampire Matthew, who anguished over the senseless loss of his innocent wife and child, and his own attempted suicide.
There will be some men or other, superstitious and blind, who see life plain in even the lowest animals and the meanest plants, but do not see life in the heavens or the world. Now if those little men grant life to the smallest particles of the world, what folly, what envy, neither to know that the whole, in which we live and move and have our being, is itself alive, nor to wish this to be so.
Title: The Book of Life, or Three Books of Life. Author: Marsilio Ficino, 1433-99. Background: This is the work from which the final book in the trilogy takes its title. The Book of Life, made up of three volumes and published in 1489, is a broad and significant work by one of the leading humanist intellectuals of the Renaissance, Marsilio Ficino. Based in Florence in the 15th century, Ficino was a philosopher, scholar, and priest under the patronage of the powerful Medici. Cosimo de' Medici chose him to head up his Platonic Academy in Florence. Like all the humanists of his age, Ficino combined study of the classics with a Christian worldview, and he was famous for his translations of Plato's work, bringing him back to the fore in Renaissance thought and reviving his ideas about the immortality of the soul. Ficino's studies also ranged from astrology to medicine, undoubtedly influenced by his father, who had been a physician to the Medici. The Book of Life is Ficino's all-encompassing guide on how to live a healthy, fulfilling life, both physically and mentally. Split into three books, On Healthy Life, On Long Life, and On Obtaining Life from the Heavens, the entire volume is a complicated mix of medical, philosophical, astrological, and magical advice. Ficino also endorsed a natural magic, which looked for remedies in the natural world and the movement of the planets, but stayed away from magic that involved the worship of demons. From letters of the time, it seems the astrological and magical elements in this book still sparked unwelcome murmurings of heresy that concerned Ficino. But fortunately, these did not come to anything.
Letters are signs of things, symbols of words, whose power is so great that without a voice they speak to us the words of the absent, for they introduce words by the eye, not by the ear.
Title: Etymologiae, The Etymologies. Author: Isidore of Seville, circa 560-636. Background: Alone in Matthew's study after he left Septuor to investigate the break-in at Oxford, Diana discovered a manuscript copy of Etymologiae. It represented Isidore of Seville's attempt to capture all of human knowledge, and it would have appealed to Matthew's endless curiosity. Matthew was eager to learn everything there was to know after his rebirth as a vampire, and this 7th-century equivalent of the Internet was a good start. Indeed, in 1997, Pope John Paul II suggested that Isidore be recognized as the patron saint of the Internet, though this has not yet been formalized. Isidore was the Archbishop of Seville from about the year 600 until his death in 636. He is known mainly for his authorship of Etymologiae, a 20-volume compendium of writings dating from the 4th century to the 6th. Isidore's purpose was to set down all the knowledge of his time, probably to provide an education for clergy. For centuries, his encyclopedia was a principal reference source and a staple of almost every monastic library. Nearly 1,000 manuscript copies survive today, and it was among the earliest books to be printed, 1472,